in Zen, in the practice or koan practice, there are many entry-level koans we start out with. Does a dog have Buddha nature? What is the sound of one hand clapping? So there's many of these you've probably heard of them, about them. And one of those entry-level koans is the question, who are you? So this morning, I'm going to ask you that question. Who are you? So for a new student, and even a student who's ongoing, it's most likely that the answer will be some version of the story about who they think they are, who we think we are. Who am I? Who are you? The answer is usually who I think I am. So I'll tell you about my childhood, I'll tell you about my occupation, I'll tell you about my marriage, I'll tell you about a variety of things so that you know who I am. But in telling you this story about who I think I am, I can see no further. As I said, I can think no further of a me, of a Carl, that I have created by my thinking. And this is a me that is separate from others, separate from the world around us. And this sense of a separate self is confirmed by thousands of daily experiences. It's also, I mean, there's a million things that contribute to this. We live in a hero culture. Right? So a hero is an individual being. Right? I am a hero. He or she is a hero. There's also the consumer culture. You know, endlessly, the consumer world, the Madison Avenue world, is going to make you someone special. If you have the right clothing, the right car, etc., you will be important. You will be desirable. Not just you, but I, we will be these things. We also value independence. This is a culture that is very heavily invested in independence. But it's an independence that exists in relation to something or someone else. It's about me as an individual, me as separate from you. Now, for many of us, we wind up coming to Zen practice because in some way we have a sense that there is something beyond this me that I am so used to being, expressing. And the practice of Zazen helps us to wipe away the fog, the layers through which we see life and our relationship with it. You know, I don't know, for some reason when I was writing this, I remembered when Ben, my son, was maybe 3 years old, and he used to take all his blankets like a cocoon and wrap himself up in bed at night. So when I would come in the morning, I wasn't able to see him right away, right? And in a sense, I wasn't able to see who he was. But slowly, I'd peel off the blankets, and there is my son, Ben. So Zen is a practice of peeling away the blankets in a sense, is a metaphor that surround us, and having an experience that's different than being self-centered. It's a way of seeing our life and our relationship with it, which is the direct experience beyond all the blankets that we wrap ourselves in. And if we practice Zazen wholeheartedly, what usually happens is our mind begins to become still. And the incessant thinking that goes on every day, from morning till night, and even when we sleep, that thinking slows down. And we start to see that we are more than our stories. So it's like this. When we start out, this little bit is how we see ourselves. And we respond to the question by this little bit of that exists in here. But as the mind slows down, this little segment becomes wider and wider and wider and wider and wider until eventually I am everything. I am everybody. Who am I? You don't even need words. So we get beyond the confinement of who we think we are. And something else happens, which is so that who we sit becomes more and more, and we start to realize the oneness of everything and everyone, the oneness of life itself with which we are part of. So, you know, how does this happen? How do we wind up being this separate being? So I'm going to start to entertain this question with a poem by Peter Levitt. And this is from a book of poems, his poems, entitled 100 Butterflies. So he writes, "Already at birth, I was parted, not just from my mother, but body from mind, mind from its source. That's why I take up this soft blade of breath to cut me back into one." So this practice is that soft blade of breath. So to go further about this, and so I'm going to talk sort of biologically and psychologically, oh, there's a million other aspects to this. The womb is a place of oneness and intimacy. And when we leave the womb, we enter the world of this and that. And we begin a lifelong immersion into this duality. And so how does this take place? So a helpful way to understand this is to look at some of the ways that we develop psychologically and biologically. And one of the most rapidly developing parts of a newborn is its brain. And research shows that a newborn starts thinking even before it learns to speak. Babies as young as 5 months old make distinctions and categories, certain types of events. The nature of this categorization changes. And becomes more sophisticated with age. And as the child's learning evolves, he or she is introduced to a variety of names, concepts, identities, hierarchies, goods, bads, etc. And this process continues as they move through life. They go to school, they go to high school, they leave, they go to work, and throughout life in general, this process of thinking and manufacturing a self that is separate from the world around it. And so this contributes to a world, to a view of the world as dualistic, as made up of many distinct and separate parts. And this is all created through the process of our experience through thinking. And the thinking mind creates this division. We need to see one thing is separate from another thing. That my car is separate from the car that's in front of me that's stopping. So, in a sense, you could say thinking is necessary so we don't bump into the car that's in front of us. But we become attached to this way of experiencing the world because of how we develop as a human being. So this thinking also plays a large part in the way that we see the world and experiences ourselves in relationship to it, right? Which is what I've been saying. It's me and you. It's me and Court. Right? Court has his own definition, the whole who he is that's been created by him. And I have my own definition of who I am that's created by me, my thinking. And that makes Court and I separate individuals. Now, researchers estimate that we have about 3,000 to 5,000 thoughts per day. The frequency and the content of these thoughts create what we call reality. And as the existentialists say, we are what we think. So just a couple of quick examples of how thinking affects our perception of ourselves and the world around us. Now, I recently read an article, and a lot of you are probably familiar with this, but it's about how surgeons are trained to be very careful of the conversations they have during surgery, even though the person is under anesthesia. And the reason for this is that research shows that negative suggestions, such as, ooh, he's a real bleeder, or she's going to have a tough recovery, these statements are heard subliminally and can have a pronounced negative effect on how the outcome of surgery becomes simply by producing this negative thinking. So I would suggest that if you are going to have surgery, interview your surgeon and make sure he's careful about how he is going to identify you. Right? Nobody wants to be a bleeder. So also in stress management programs, the programs focus on how the participant's self and how about their circumstance. Programs focus the participant's self and about their circumstances. Focus on that. And this attention to thoughts is based on research which shows that negative self-talk heightens stress, disrupts appetite, and disturbs sleep. Again, thinking is shaping the way we experience the world. And this thinking is not independent of our physical being. Our body has all sorts of sensations and reactions and emotions that are connected to the way that we think. So thinking and feeling take place simultaneously. So now there's an important connection to be made so that this talk doesn't end up being a dualistic talk. So if we live in a reality that's created by our thoughts, a dualistic reality, we will be out of balance, right? And we need the soft blade of breath to help us re-experience oneness and intimacy that we knew before we became separate from the source. And the doorway, as I've been talking about, back to the source and being at one with life is our practice. But even this is not enough, this realization of our oneness. Even this is not enough. Excuse me. It's not the end of our journey. Because we don't want to lean in the direction of oneness over We don't want to lean in the direction of oneness. We must be moderate. We must be centered, not leaning or holding to either expression of reality, just form and oneness, this and that, dancing together, inseparably from each other. So the in terms of this dancing, the best advice that I can give you to sum up this talk is to, you better watch your step. So thank you.